Hello and welcome to the September podcast for the September issue of the Oldie magazine with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And in our issue, we've got a fantastic article by Christopher Howes on the golden days of Soho. He's got a new book coming out in September, Soho in the 80s. Now, Christopher, in the 80s, Soho's golden days were coming to an end, but that wasn't immediately clear. It did seem like a golden age.
I thought it would go on forever, yes. And in a way, it seemed like it had in the 50s. You know, all those old dinosaurs who were by then no longer with us. People like John Deakin, the insufferable photographer who took very good photos. Or indeed, old Francis Bacon, who's still alive, but seemed to be immortal. He dressed in a funny leather jacket, blouson style, so that it covered up his paunch. And he'd stopped dyeing his hair with boot polish and use something more subtle. But he just seemed to have unconquerable energy. He would get up early and paint his horrific pictures and then spend the rest of the afternoon buying as many drinks as he could for everybody that he met in the Colony Room Club, usually. What I didn't realise is that the people that I was talking to, poets and painters and writers and layabouts, well, within a decade or so, most of them would be dead. They were pretty well all dead now, apart from Norman Baylon, the landlord of the Coach and Horses. But Geoffrey Bernard rehearsed his column in the Coach and Horses, not necessarily consciously, but you would see that if he remembered it, things that you'd been talking about the day before would find their way into a paragraph here and there. What went wrong, I wonder, after the 80s? I think the great thing about Soho in the 80s is that it was a place where people went for conversation in pubs, principally the Coach and Horses, the French pub, and the Colony Room Club, which was open in the afternoon. And I suppose one of the changes was that the licensing laws were liberalised, or at least extended, so pubs were open in the afternoon too. That took some punctuation out of the day, and also it meant there was no reason for afternoon drinking clubs anymore. It loosened things up, and after a while, people no longer went to a pub with the lively expectation of entertaining conversation. I think if you go to Soho now, very often you go there knowing that you won't be able to hear a thing, as the music's too loud. And anyway, you wouldn't want to hear because the people that you're mixing with aren't so entertaining. It's as simple as that, I think.
And to go back to the beginnings of it, why did it end up that these extraordinary people like Francis Bacon, Geoff Bernard, Tom Baker, John Hurt, Richard Ingram's Norman Ballon, why should they end up in this quite small patch of London just south of Oxford Street in the first place?
Yeah, it's partly architectural that Soho had been built in the 18th century mostly with grand houses, but they'd pretty quickly fallen in on more difficult times and gone into multiple occupation. So it meant that by the latter part of the 20th century, if you're looking for somewhere central and cheap to rent out as offices for private eye, then that would be the sort of place you'd look. At the same time, there was a parallel life with restaurants. The Soho introduced the English to the French restaurant. Kettner's in the 1860s. It was really the first well-known French restaurant that English people went to. And little by little, because of the agreeable pubs which were available, there was a mixture of people who liked drinking, didn't care for conventional morality very much, and had something to say, because their great criterion in life was not money, but things like painting and poetry. And I remember Oliver Bernard, the eldest of the three Bernard brothers, saying that when he ran away from home at the age of 16, he felt at home in Soho, because it's the sort of place where you could borrow a shilling off somebody, and really they didn't care for your status. They were interested in the things that you were throwing backwards and forwards in speech.
And the only crime in your marvellous book is being a bore, is that right?
Well, that was the great thing to be avoided, yes. And I think that was behind some of the rather hair-raising rows and abuse that were in the air. It's funny, really, because there were some people who regularly drank with us in the what we would call the deep end of the Coach and Horses. That's the end opposite where the Italian gangsters and the shoplifters drank. They were in the shallow end, but the deep end was where people had a sort of cut and thrust in their conversation. And if somebody was trying to show off, then they'd soon be flattened in some way, quite easily, actually, usually. And yet, there were unpretentious people there. There was a nice old stage door keeper called Gordon Smith, who didn't really have very much of interest to say, but it was because he didn't put on airs that he just became part of the mix. And it was a huge social mix. This is something which, I think we've lost. It was radically democratic. So you would have sort of failed actresses and people who ran market stalls and petty criminals and that sort of person all mixed up together. And I think there's also still an element in the 80s of that interwar aristocratic slumming in Bohemia. I remember I was quietly drinking in the Colony Room Club one afternoon. The Duke of Sutherland turned up. He was the Duke of Sutherland at the time. He'd been a member of the Colony Room Club for a number of years. He was also a member of the House of Lords. Now, he'd never spoken in the House of Lords. He was far too shy.
And owned half of Scotland as well, didn't he?
Yeah, owned a lot of Scotland and works of art. But he was too shy to speak in the Lords. He'd had a hard time in the war. And he found that the colony was somewhere that he would go and be accepted just as an ordinary member, that you didn't have to make a great speech. I found that rather touching, actually, in his case.
And at the same time, you're not, while loving Soho, you're not at all starry-eyed about it. You lay out very graphically the terrible casualties, of which there were many, weren't there?
Well, that was what was so extraordinary about it, because it was very funny indeed, hilarious as a place. It was funnier than any situation comedy could be on television, because the cast was huge and it was all for real. And although it was a comedy, it all ended in tragedy. The people's marriages broke up if they had them, they became homeless, they lost their money, and everybody, of course, eventually died after after great suffering physically. I mean, Geoffrey Bernard is a case in point, and Michael Heath, the marvellous cartoonist for The Spectator, noted that Geoffrey's hobby was observing his own physical dissolution, really, that he had a series of things that went wrong with him, some of them brought on by drink. I mean, he was diabetic, so he gave up drinking lime juice with his vodka on medical advice, but he was drinking a bottle or two of vodka, or the equivalent, every day. Now, this is not good for you. And after a while, his muscles wasted away, so that his knees were fatter than his thighs. He had a couple of cysts on his neck, which some very good surgeon took off for him. But then, a couple of years later, it was one leg that it was taken away because of complications of diabetes. And he would sit there making a point and emphasising it by waving his stump in the air. So, but this is, I'm afraid, typical of what happened to people who were so committed to drink and bohemianism that everything else was secondary.
And the obsession with drink is understandable. The obsession with bohemianism means that they are completely indifferent to comfort and, in a quite admirable way, getting on in the world. So here is Geoff Bernard, who I think is one of the great journalists of the late 20th century. But, well, early on in his life, he's sleeping in a doss house in Camden Town. Is that part of it? A complete indifference to comfort and getting on in the world?
Yes, I think it is that. And I think that's partly the attraction of Geoffrey Bernard's columns that people read them because he'd actually gone through with this bohemian idealism of a kind that you would have nowhere to live eventually, or indeed to start with, I suppose. In his case, he persevered by the kindness of people giving him a room to live in. And as you say, he was in that huge doss house in Camden Town, which people got to know quite well. I think that there's an example of Boozer's economics. A friend of mine who was the drunkest man in the Coach and Horses, Graham Mason, he would spend money in the pub, and he would spend money on a minicab to get home. He lived in the Isle of Dogs in a so-called hard-to-let flat. That was quite daunting. And he knew he had to spend money on a minicab because he wasn't capable of making his own way home after a day's hard drinking. And yet his clothes, he wouldn't buy clothes. He wore the cast-off clothes of the dead husband of the widow that he lived with, which didn't quite fit. His arms and legs were quite long, and so he would wear out the sleeves sort of halfway along the wrist where his elbow rubbed them. One day he had his coat hanging up in the Coach and Horses, an old duffel coat. It was a horrible object, really, and it lost its colour. It was supposed to be navy, and it had sort of gone pinky round the edges where all the colour had washed out. Some idiot stole it. And that was a rare occasion when I saw Geoffrey Bernard perform what can only be called a good deed, really. He said, "Follow me," to Graham Mason, and took him over to Austin Reed's round the corner in Regent Street, as it was then, and bought him a proper, not quite a British warm, I think it was a sort of Crombie coat, actually, rather smart. And Graham was, I could see he was touched. He might not have been, he might have taken against it, but he was touched. And yet he always had that edge. He gave it a sort of nickname. He referred to it ever after as Geoffrey's coat. He was painted in that coat by a friend of mine, Rupert Shrive, who's a good painter. And I've got it hanging up in my kitchen now. And so that's a good reminder of all these dead people.
And the survivors, like Norman Bell and Richard Ingrams, and indeed yourself, give up drink. Was that the only way really to survive, do you think, in the end?
Well, it depends how taken you were with it. I mean, Michael Heath, the cartoonist, likes a drink, but he's not an alcoholic. It's very interesting that some people aren't. And it's quite rare, though. People usually manage to make it so habitual that it takes over their lives. And so I think you might be right that Richard Ingram just gave up drink over a weekend early in his career at Private Eye. And some people, I think, thought that he was looking down on them slightly. He used to refer to the deep end, the Coach and Horses, as Wino's Corner. But nevertheless, he's sort of having lunch with Peter Cook. Peter Cook, I mean, took all sorts of things, but he certainly enjoyed drinking a pint or two of white wine at lunchtime. And it used to go on this extraordinary free association sprees, which were part of his comedy. It wasn't showing off, it was just part of his makeup. And of course, he conked out pretty quickly.
Did you realise at the time, that sounds wonderful to me as a fan of both Richard Ingrams and Peter Cook, what could be more enjoyable? Did you realise at the time that it was, to use an annoying expression, a golden age?
I thought it was unusual. I don't think I did know it was a golden age, no. I thought it would go on forever, because I didn't properly think about it. And I suppose the reason I left it 30 years until I wrote about it was because perspective gives a different insight into what was going on. I'll tell you what was also a parallel, that in the 80s, Daniel Farson, who was a great monster, he was a marvellous photographer and quite a good writer. He wrote a book called Soho in the 50s. Well, that was 30 years after the events. And goodness me, it's now 30 years after the events of the 80s. And I can see elsewhere in things people write that they get things wrong, they get the flavour wrong. And so I thought it'd be a good idea to do a memoir, really, which is not about me, it's about what I saw as a little bearded camera in those days. and then scribbling bits down, luckily, in some notebooks that I found, because otherwise I wouldn't have remembered a great deal about what was going on.
And actually, Christopher, as well as being a marvellous book full of wonderful stories, it's brilliant, these precise details. So there are maps of the most famous pubs and drinking clubs. That was part of your intention, was it, to give a sort of really sharp picture of everything, down to how people handled their change,
yes,
what drink they drank?
No, no, that's very important. No, I think that's true about the maps. So there are plans, really, of the principal places, like the Coach and Horses and the Colony. And it did make a huge amount of difference. It was like being on a ship. Every detail was familiar to everybody, so they could sort of feel their way to the door, if they could scarcely see in the evenings, for the smoke and their own drunkenness. And where you were also was significant, and you knew where to find people. And I suppose there was a kind of top dog attitude in some of the drinking holes there.
Depending on fame, I have Richard Ingram's or... John Hurt would be treated with some deference.
No, I don't think it was like that at all. No, sorry, I don't think it was. No, it was on a more local power basis. Richard Ingram is marvellous because he's an outside observer most of the time, it seems, in his life. And he has his own status and he's never worried about it. So he's like, I don't know, he's somebody who walks into the Wild West Saloon but doesn't pick a fight. He doesn't need to. John Hurt used to drink in the Coach and Colony and other drinking places because he liked to drink a lot. He's one of those actors who sort of took time off, and I suppose getting terribly drunk was part of some kind of therapy. I'm not sure it did him any good.
Well, lived to a great age. Yeah.
He lived quite a time. He also gave up drink eventually, but there it is. But I don't think there was any difference, no, because they didn't have any more status than, in a way, the stage doorkeeper. They were accepted. If they'd been regarded as bores, then they'd have been cold-shouldered, or worse, they'd have been hot-tongued, as it were, shouted at. Or so that somebody would have been rude in some way to them.
What about as a newcomer? When did you first turn up in Soho?
Well, in the mid-80s, I went a few times and read a book, you know, the way one does in a strange pub, observing what was going on. But I think it was when I started working for The Spectator that I got into the swim of it, because I used to, on Thursday lunchtimes, take Geoffrey his copy of The Spectator, which he usually had his column in, as he was too unwell to do it. Geoffrey Bernard is unwell, it used to say at the bottom, if there was nothing that he could write. And it didn't mean that he was drunk, it meant that he had some kind of terrible illness, usually.
And was it intimidating to begin with? Starting.
Well, I was a bit of an idiot, naturally, so I didn't realise that these waters were shark infested. I didn't know the difference between the shallow end and the deep end. I'm glad that I jumped in the deep end, because I wouldn't have got on with the shoplifters very much at the shallow end. They didn't have very much conversation. And I think that was a bit of luck on my part, and I enjoyed joking with the people at the time, and that was my only weapon, really. I couldn't fight. Not that anybody fought very much with fisticuffs. That some of them could. But I was quite happy to join in the cup and thrust of speech. It was very entertaining.
And do you go back there now at all?
Well, it's like going back to college, you know, if you've been to university and you go back. You can't really go back because it's not the same place, and it certainly isn't now. There's nothing wrong with the Coach and Horses now, or indeed the French pub, which still has some survivors drinking away there. But the magic's gone, the whole structure has gone, it's a different place. So I didn't leave Soho, Soho left me.
And you end, in a moving way, you refer to all the casualties, but you say you were glad you were there, and nothing has replaced it anywhere in Britain, is that right?
Well, it's difficult to tell, isn't it? I can't see that it has, really, because even writing and painting have changed a great deal. The young British artists in the 1990s, I mean, the first thing they learned was how to make out an invoice. And what happens with writers? Well, very often when you see a little profile of a writer, it tells you what prizes they've won. I mean, who cares what prizes they've won? It's what they write that matters. And talking about that, I don't know where people talk about it. I mean, there are clubs, but I've not come across sort of free and open discussion of writing and painting in the same way.
Also in a very boring way, sorry to mention the two words, but it's got something to do with house prices, that you really can't survive in central London now and be a freelance artist, writer, and stay late at night in Soho. Well, it's a tough decision.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, a lot of the people that I was drinking with didn't really have anywhere much to live anyway. I mean, there was a marvellous man who's a driver, God help us, called Bill Moore, who used to drink huge amounts of whiskey. And if, see, he didn't want to drink so much whiskey. And he would sit at the bar wearing his jersey and no shirt. And he would sleep in the deck chair in his boss's office. Now, that wouldn't cost you very much.
Yeah, still, yeah.
But I think perhaps things have tightened up now and people don't like drivers sleeping in deck chairs in their office.
Well, that's a very good place to stop. Thank you so much to Christopher Howes for his brilliant article in the September issue of The Oldie about his book Soho in the 80s.